Hey, I hope you and Larry have a wonderful Thanksgiving. Take care. Thanks for the podcast. It's great. Bye.
Recording live from FYP Studios West and an undisclosed location. Transmitting across the internet, this is episode 52 of Registry Matters. Good evening, Larry. How are you?
Doing great, Andy. How are you?
I'm well. It's kind of cold where I am, though. They, Thanksgiving Day, it didn't go above freezing, which was pretty stellar.
Not quite that cold here, but it has chilled out.
Yes, no doubt. I think the United States is definitely feeling a little bit of a cold spell. So here we are on it's Friday night, which is not normally our day to record. And there was just some stuff that came out this week. With like the final article that we're going to cover, it just seemed that we kind of needed to put something together, spur of the moment, even though I was traveling. And so hope you guys appreciate the quote unquote bonus episode.
Well, it shows the dedication of the FYP staff.
Absolutely. And they deserve a raise.
We're not going to miss a podcast unless it's unavoidable because of our loyal audience that we're trying to serve.
We did. We received a voicemail message from our regular out of Tennessee, and he wanted to throw in some questions and comments regarding the individual that we interviewed last week with the marijuana. So here's right. William.
Hello, this is William again, and I'm still listening to the latest episode 51. Let's talk about shower heads and listening to that poor gentleman up in Kentucky who can't get medical marijuana to curb the nausea, which is the side effect of the chemo he's taking. And I wanted to ask a question. How much of this resistance to decriminalizing is because of the influence, number one, of your privatized correctional companies? And I guarantee you the biggest segment of their offenders are drug offenders, and marijuana is a big part of that. So you're cutting profit from the private prisons who have a very powerful lobby. Not only that, look at how many federal, state and federal employees make money off of marijuana. Look how many agencies can profit by seizing assets of people who have been found in possession of a certain quantity of marijuana. And I wonder also how much Big Pharma plays into this, because if there is something natural like marijuana that treats seizure disorders and nausea from chemo better than their super expensive medications, how much lobby from the drug industry is going in to fight legalization of marijuana, because it would cut their profits? And I just wanted to throw that 2 cents in there, because every time I listen to your pod, it gets me to thinking, and I always, with the government, follow the money. Again, thank you for the great work you do, and that's just my 2 cents on that issue. Have a good one.
If we roll the clock back, my brother-in-law died of HIV way, way, way back, pretty fairly early in the epidemic. And he was just pretty much naturally resistant to it. And I recall information coming out then that vitamin C in mass doses was very much a would help stave off the end results. And, you know, this is before, like today, it's just you take some pills and you will live basically a normal life. But back then it was a death sentence. And I wonder if vitamin C is just, you know, just an over-the-counter thing. You can buy it in a gazillion pills for $2. How much, you know, so related to that comment there at the end talking about Big Pharma, I don't believe in conspiracy theories, so some of that stuff seems like, I'm not so sure. But I definitely could see that Big Pharma would be opposed to having medicinal marijuana because it's just something you could grow in your backyard.
Well, every time I hear William, I like him more and more, because he's actually zeroed in on a lot of what's going on. I've been privy to a lot of the discussion on the legalization of marijuana. And they don't say those things directly about the correctional system, but indirectly it's there. But they disguise it, and they claim that it's because it's a gateway drug, and that the crime is going to be that they're going to move from that drug to harder drugs, and the crime is going to go through the roof. But I'm thinking that he's actually right on target, because the status quo, whatever it is, it's difficult to get people to want to change, because if you all of a sudden don't have all these people going through the system and receiving jail time, jobs are at stake. This is big business. And you start talking about closing a prison, and if you look around, most prisons are not located in urban areas unless they have to. But if you look at your state prison systems, your federal prison systems, they're typically located out of urban zones. And that's the big employer of the town.
Right.
I mean, you think about with your Georgia Department of Corrections, how many of them were located in urban settings that you can recall?
Yeah, I mean, the only way that I was ever going to get a visit was to have someone drive 2 or 3 hours to come see me.
And so I tend to think that he's actually got it analyzed correctly. I have not heard those arguments directly, but they're not going to make those arguments publicly at a hearing. Those are the type of arguments they're going to make. The lobbyist is going to come in and make those one-on-one with the lawmaker, and it's going to be in a confidential setting where they're hoping that it's not going to be repeated. They're not going to say this is going to drive us out of business. Now, if it's something that's not as hot button emotional as this issue, the taxi industry will come in and say Uber's driving us out of business. They'll actually say that publicly. But I've not heard the people that are opposed to legalization of marijuana saying that you're going to drive our pharma, our sales of big expensive drugs down. I've not heard, but I have heard them actually say that they're concerned about all the hoops they have to jump through to have their drugs approved. And then this here has not ever been approved by the FDA, which is correct as far as I know. Has the FDA approved the medicinal benefits of marijuana?
No, I'm pretty sure that's no, but that would also go to, has cocaine ever been approved? That's also Schedule I, but that's used in hospital settings.
It is?
Well, maybe not cocaine, excuse me, heroin. There are those, maybe it's, I guess morphine. Morphine is what I'm thinking
morphine,
of. Then.
Yes,
never mind.
Yes, morphine, yeah, morphine.
And that's probably on the list of things that haven't been FDA approved. I'm just going to guess, Schedule I drug, they can't do a whole lot of testing on it because, it's banned by the federal government.
Well, I like William's train of thought. I think that he may be on to all of this has a bearing on money and the displacement that's going to happen. When we make radical changes, it's going to displace people. That's why we're hanging on to fossil fuels for dear life, because
But on the flip side of that, it opens up new jobs for people to transition into something else. Obviously we don't have people making horseshoes very much anymore. Got jobs elsewhere.
I know, but that's a scary thing. I mean, we've gone through this radical change from an industrial country to an information technology-based country, and it's left a lot of people behind. And that's had a lot to do with the 2016 election, because people who had good-paying, stable careers in the heavy industry no longer have those jobs, and it's a scary thing. A lot of people with a 2.4 million, whatever it is, 2.4, 2.6 million people incarcerated, another millions more under supervision. This is big business in America. We're not talking about something that doesn't affect people's lives. It affects a lot of people's lives.
Oh, certainly. Are you ready to move on and cover some articles?
Let's do it.
All right. The first article that we have comes from the Marshall Project, and it is covering the details of the First Step Act. And one of the ones that I keep reading about that I just can't even fathom is how you'd ever consider shackling a woman who's giving birth. That one drives me absolutely insane. But that's in here. It's under the category of enforcing existing rules. But I know that was something in Georgia that just passed in either 14 or 16. How in the world do you think that, like, a woman as she's popping out a baby is going to cause you some grief and possibly run away?
Well, I've said that for years. And what troubles me is, why would you even need to make a law for prohibiting that? Why would anybody who makes decisions in the policy arena, whether it be your local elected sheriff that has the responsibility to guard a prisoner who's taken from county jail to the hospital, why would you need that, Mr. Sheriff, to have the law tell you not to shackle a woman who's in the middle of giving birth? You claim you don't want big government. Why is it that you force big government to prohibit you from doing something that you can figure out on your own volition that it's not needed. It's dehumanizing, and you're doing it for whatever reason you're doing it. Maybe I don't know what your reasons are. I wouldn't even begin to speculate, but it's not warranted. And why we need to have a law to do that is beyond me.
Don't you think that like somebody did do something bad, so then they're like, well, hey, you know, we're not going to let that happen again. So just, you know, everyone gets punished at the expense of the one person that did something bad, or not at the expense of, but because someone did something bad, you know, corporal punishment.
I have not heard of the specific instance where a woman has done something that would threaten an officer in the middle of childbirth. Now, when do you take the shackles off? Since I don't have any experience in birthing, I don't know when the shackles should come off. But for a woman not to be able to have her baby and have freedom of movement of her arms and her extremities and to be able to hold her child after it's born, to me, I don't know how you sleep with yourself after you've done this and you call yourself a religious, Bible-believing Christian and you do this to another human being, really? But anyway, but to the point.
Yeah, I know. Wow, you're going off on a tangent there. There were also things about reducing some of the mandatory minimums, giving judges the freedom to pursue what kind of sentence they believe would be right.
Well, what we're talking about is the bill that's sitting waiting for Mitch McConnell to move. This is the first step.
Correct.
That we talked about in the previous episode where we played the recording of Senator Lindsey Graham. Making it clear that it's the Republican Party holding this up, just so we make sure we reiterate that on this podcast.
Yeah, sure. Well, he said he would bring it to the floor if he had 60 votes, and Graham says, "Well, you've got 80. Hang on, I know that we're talking from like a legal perspective, and it's not mathematically oriented. Is 80 more than 60?
I'm thinking it is. Yes, I'm thinking
okay.
It would be.
It's a pretty strong number higher than it's not like a close margin. It's not like a 51-49 split in the Senate.
Well, I could see Mitch's position if he thought that their 60 votes weren't there, because you have a problem in the Senate if you can't get to what's called cloture, and you need 60 votes to get to cloture. So if Mitch genuinely believes that it's a controversial thing and it's dividing his caucus, it would be reasonable to say, well, if you don't have enough votes to get the cloture, I'm not going to have a bunch of time debating this because we've got some other work that we need to get done in the lame duck session, which is a session that follows the election, the midterm election. But his own colleague is telling him, you not only have the votes for cloture, you have 20 votes to spare.
Yeah.
And you still won't do it. So you can't blame that you might get bogged down in controversial debate and it might eat up all this time, because if Lindsey's right, if Senator Graham is right, there are plenty of votes to spare. So, Mitch, you just don't want to do it. Let's be honest. You don't want to do this, do you?
Which then, you know, I keep coming back up, and I say this to many people that I end up having lunch or dinner with, and I'm just like, we're just assholes in this country. We just don't care. If it's not mine, well, I don't care about you. I don't need to worry about helping the guy across the street. It's about me making sure that I'm covered, and F you.
Yep. Well, I'm hoping that our thousands of listeners in Tennessee and Kentucky put pressure on Mitch McConnell, the leader who controls the calendar.
Right.
Us liberal do-gooders on the other side of the aisle, we can't make this happen. We're in the minority. It's your leadership, and it's your call if you want this vote to happen.
The next article, though, comes out of Kansas.com. Wichita, Kansas. And this is, I'm going to need some help, but if I understand this right, some inmates were talking to their attorneys and those recordings got released. And because of that, then I guess then the prosecutor has some inside information, and that makes almost like an illegal search and seizure of evidence that they have some inside knowledge about the case. Is that halfway close?
That's very close. You did a fine job with your quick read.
It's my lack of understanding, mostly.
Yes, we've long since held to the belief that attorney-client communications are privileged, even in correctional settings. And although I found this article, I can't open it right now. For some reason, it's just spinning away. But that is, in essence, what's happened is that they're attempting to get the charges dismissed, because there has to be a consequence for misconduct Otherwise, misconduct will continue. And the way you have a consequence is the cases that you benefited from committing the misconduct go away, and perhaps maybe you won't do it again. And it finally opened for me. So the Federal Public Defender's Office has asked for the release of 67 inmates from Kansas Federal Prison and plans to seek freedom for more than 150 others because authorities secretly recorded conversations between prisoners and their attorneys. It's like, hello, do you not understand what you're supposed to do when there's an attorney-client meeting taking place?
And it says that's the Sixth Amendment to the Constitution, right?
Yes. Yeah, like I say, it's long established. This is not something new.
Let me ask you this, though. We're going to cover an article. It's either next or the one after that, where they're talking about, do the states have to follow the amendments to the Constitution, the sixth being one of the Bill of Rights? Do the states then have some sort of angle that they can say, no, we're not going to follow that one because we don't want to?
That has been tried through the ages, and usually they ultimately end up that the courts say that you're part of the United States and the Constitution applies to the states, to the federal government. But it was written at the time, the framers were talking about the federal. I mean, they were restricting and imposing on the federal. This was the federal constitution, but the courts have interpreted to apply to the states. So I would be surprised if they don't interpret this to apply to the states as well. But these are federal inmates here. This is a federal public defender.
Yeah, okay. It does say that in the first sentence. Duh. All right. Because I was going to say that we have discussed that, like, Maryland's constitution is more restrictive in some certain aspects. So you can make it more gooder than you can make it less gooder. You can make it more gooder than the constitution, more strict, more protections and so forth. So I was wondering if this wouldn't be something similar to that, where
provide greater. But not less. You can provide your state residents greater protections than U.S. Constitution, but you have to provide that as the baseline. But like separation of church and state, you know, that before the and I can't tell you the exact year the Supreme Court held that applies to the state government, the state and local governments as well. But that was that doctrine. If you looked at the Constitution, they were trying to separate. The framers were thinking more about the separation of state and the federal. I mean, separation of church and state at the federal level. But the Supreme Court said, nope, it applies. You can't have a mixture of church and state at any level of government.
Yeah. And so because of that, it is some 67 people could have their cases then thrown out because of this?
That's what it appears to be saying. There was supposed to be a hearing Friday. U.S. District Judge Julie Robinson will hear arguments Friday in Kansas City. So
that
was
Friday today, Friday or last week Friday?
I'm assuming it was today, but not sure if it was based on the date of the article.
Okay. Well, number 16th, we're not that far past it.
We probably need to follow up on this on the next and see how the judge ruled if we can get some more information. But you got to follow the rules when you run a correctional facility. You have legitimate security considerations, and they mentioned that in the article about contraband. But you can't just make up your own rules and break all the expectations of privacy between the attorney and client just because you've got contraband issues. Maybe you can do more search of the attorneys when they come out or when they come in.
That's what I was just going to say. Wouldn't that be then, hey, look, this attorney has been known to be a problem, so then we're either going to – he can't come in or – he gets a more thorough search. My attorney came in a couple of times and she just went through a Sally port and she was in.
Yes. And we've got correctional facilities here that do full body scans like they do at the airport, you know, where they look to see what all you, but securing the institution, the courts will give great deference to that, but intruding on the conversations, that's none of your business.
Right. Right. And yeah, I mean, I guess it's one thing if the prison guards are in there listening and giggling and cracking up. But if that information then ends up to the prosecutor, you've got big problems because you could flat out just admit to everything to your attorney. And then the prosecutor's just got, hey, I got this recording of the guy admitting to it to his attorney. How does the judge then let that even go through?
Well, I'm hoping not.
Right. Moving on to, hey, look, SCOTUS blog. This is SCOTUSblog.com, which gets reviewed often. Actually, Amy Howe is a contributing person to a podcast network that I follow for tech stuff. And this is about whether the Eighth Amendment ban on excessive fines applies at the state level. So an individual named Tyson Timms in Indiana, who lost his Land Rover after his conviction on state drug charges. Yeah, where would you draw the line on excessive fines? Oh, that was the thing that William was saying inside of his voicemail message. You get convicted of XYZ drug charges and they go confiscate everything, and it may or may not be drug related. I can see them taking your drug paraphernalia stuff. Okay, but what does that have to do with your house or your car or your cash? I mean, ostensibly you've made those purchases to essentially launder that money, but there's no it's not necessarily direct evidence of it.
Well, the issue before the Supreme Court in the next article is about all the amicus briefs that are coming in, because the Supreme Court was going to hear oral arguments next week, which this article, since it's dated 21st, it will be next week that they're going to hear the oral arguments. But there's excessive fines, and the argument is a very, very creative one, that taking a person's property amounts to a fine, although you're not calling it a fine. In this case, right, the vehicle was $42,000 in value, and it's being confiscated. That's a significant fine. So does the state have the prerogative of levying that excessive of a fine? And does the Constitution prohibition against excessive? We'll find out.
Right. Well, and that goes to what we were just talking about, the Sixth Amendment. If that, granted, that article was about federal people, but if they decided at the state level, say, hey, we don't have to follow the Sixth Amendment, what stops them from not following the First, Second, Third, Fourth, up through the Tenth, and all the way through the 27th Amendment? What prevents them from not following the rest of them?
So the Intermediate Court of Appeals decided that it was an excessive fine, but the state Supreme Court, this is an Indiana case, the state Supreme Court reversed, and that's how it gets before the U.S. Supreme Court, because there's a U.S. constitutional issue. So there's been a cert petition filed and approved. The court is intrigued by this issue, and they want to resolve this question. And we will find out, and we'll see which way the conservatives go down and which way the liberals
go
down.
So what do you then, what would you then consider to be their general positions from a liberal conservative point of view? Are they going to err on the side of following the Constitution, or are they going to err on following what the states want to do?
My hunch is this one's going to be a complicated one for the for the conservatives to square their conscience, because they're going to want to defer to the states, but this is so extreme that they might even come aboard. So I would imagine you're going to have the four liberals, and you're possibly going to get a fifth and sixth vote out of the conservatives on this. But they are going to struggle with it. I can be quite certain of that. But they already had four that thought it was an interesting case to grant certiorari to hear it.
Right. Because the 10th Amendment, not to quote it verbatim, says the federal government will have no power that which it was not given to by the states. So the states are like kind of sort of more powerful than the federal government, just in that they decide what the federal government has. It just seems interesting that they are trying to sort of buck the authority that they gave the federal government to impose the Constitution back down on them. I don't know, kind of like, you know, when you point, you have three fingers pointing back. It feels to me it's sort of like that it's a little role reversal coming back on them.
Well, according to one of the briefs here, that in 2012, which just goes to William's point, the 26 states and the District of Columbia took in more than $254 million through forfeiture under state laws alone. Excessive fines are a particular problem in Indiana. He notes state laws allow prosecutors to outsource forfeiture cases to private lawyers who take the case on contingency fees and pocket hundreds of thousands of dollars every year based on forfeitures. Now, I don't think those lawyers are going to want this to go away. Do you?
Right. No, certainly not. I remember a case within the last year, somebody's just making a road trip, him and his girlfriend, and in some random state they get pulled over and they had a big chunk of cash. Let's say it was 50 grand. They were apparently not doing anything wrong, but for however the cop ended up searching the car, they then confiscate the cash. And they're like, we're not giving you the cash back. Like, that's my money. No, you can't have it back. But it's my money. Sorry, we need it for evidence. Evidence for what? We think there might be a crime. What crime? And they just held on the cash for months. And now the couple doesn't have any cash.
Well, I mean, clearly, if a person is running around with cash, Andy, there's no justification for that. You need to be using the banking system, and you need to be running debit cards and credit cards. And of course, if a person has cash, they obviously are up to no good. And I don't understand why you can't understand that.
Yeah, that's my bad. My bad.
We've had a similar discussion in private times, and you tell me you don't understand why anybody would run around with cash. So that's what I'm saying here.
No, I wouldn't. I don't ever carry cash. I just don't. But that doesn't mean you can't. If you want to, I don't know why you would, but I mean, it's hard to transport. It's not secure. It is very anonymous, though, sort of. I mean, if you hand people hundreds of dollars of bills, they're going to be suspicious of your activities. But man, knock yourself out. I don't see the point. It's bulky and awkward, man. Give me my Google Tap to Pay and I'm out.
Yeah, until the sunspots take the system down, then you're not out.
Yeah, well, okay. Do you have thousands of dollars in your mattress or your pillowcase?
I do.
Oh, geez. Okay. Yeah. You and you're carrying your shower heads around. Never mind. I forgot who I was talking to.
I'm prepared for at least to be able to get through the initial crashing of the system, because I just about bet you, even though people can't count anymore and make change backwards, I just about bet that retailers, rather than shutting down, will be very preferential to people who have cash, and they'll try to find an old-fashioned box somewhere, and they'll let you pay for merchandise if you have cash. What do you bet?
I bet. I think now is a good time to go over that story where you were at McDonald's, maybe, and you paid for something. You gave the person an extra nickel so they could give you two quarters back or whatever that was.
I don't remember the details, but it's just so common that all you have to do is make it up. from any time you're making change in a person, if they've keyed in the amount tendered, and you want to hand them something else so that you get an even amount back, they cannot figure out what to do. And they pull out a calculator and try to figure out what to do. And I tell them, look, all you have to do is look at your screen where it says change to return and add whatever I hand you back to that. And it'll be right 100% of the time. And they just don't believe it'll be right. They say,
you are trying to run some scam on them. They're trying to get, you know, there was a skit on Cheers once where the magician Harry Anderson had come in there, and he got Coach with like, here, can I get change for this five? So he gets five ones back, and he kept spinning it around, and he ended up walking out of there with $100.
You can do the quick change, but if a person's register says give you $12.95 back and you hand them a nickel, you add the nickel to $12.95 and you owe them $13. I mean, it's not that complicated. And I tell them, don't need a calculator. Just add to whatever that tells you, and they just can't add forward. And another thing is, if you have to count a register till back to a certain amount as a fixed change fund, they cannot. They'll have bags of money everywhere. They'll have their calculators out, and they'll be trying to count it back to 100. And they'll start with the paper, and I said, no, start with the pennies and do your pennies first. So when you get to 67 pennies, take out the two extras. Then you've got 65, and then you start with your nickels, and you go 70, 75, 80, 85, 90. And then when you get to the nickels, you take out the extra nickel, so you'll have a dime. So you'll be counting increments of 10, and they just can't do that. And they'll have change going everywhere. And I'll say, no, the change stays in the drawer. We're trying to keep the change in the drawer. There'll be a little tiny bit of change will come out. There'll be an extra two or three pennies that'll come out, an extra nickel that'll come out, maybe a dime. But basically, all your change is going to stay in the drawer, and you're going to go that direction. But they can't do it. And I'm shocked at how you can make it through school, college, and be running a cash register, and you cannot count a till back to $100 without having gobs of change everywhere and your calculator out.
Well, you had mentioned that there were some amicus briefs being filed, and I guess this comes from Bloomberg Law.
Yes.
So this is a companion article to the one we just covered, and you have the NAACP, the National NACDL, the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, Judicial Watch, the Pacific League Foundation. You've got all kinds of groups that are coming in support of making sure that they force the Eighth Amendment, or that they want to confiscate everybody's things.
No, all these. I don't say all of them because I didn't go through read all the briefs, but all these organizations that are mentioned are on the right side of this, against the Indiana Supreme Court's interpretation.
Can you give us any indication as to why the Indiana Supreme Court would say that $42,000 of confiscating that Land Rover is not excessive fines?
Well, it would be speculation because I don't know how they get their judges on the Supreme Court if they're elected by the will of the popular vote. I don't know enough about Indiana politics and about the system, but I would say that that it's certainly very creative on their part to come up with that. I mean, you can rule any way you want to, and come up with you could, when you decide how you want to go, you can usually find some authority to support you. And yeah, and if sure. I read their decision, I could probably see how they justified it. But it sure seems like a fine to me. But you could take the same position that the Supreme Court took in the Affordable Care Act. They said, well, no, it's not anything but a tax. If you don't have insurance, and you're not required to have insurance, you're assessed a tax, and the Congress has the certainly the authority to levy a tax. Well, if the other people argued, well, no, it isn't a tax; it's a penalty. No, it's a tax. Now, which is it? Is this a fine, or is this a civil administrative remedy to keep the tools of the criminality from being used? Which is it? Of course, I know in my mind, since I know the police make it a big part of their budget, that this is designed as a fine and as a funding source. But you could argue it. You could come up with some creative arguments why it's not a fine.
Shouldn't it kind of go the other way? Like, we're going to budget for what we need to operate, and any sort of fines that we collect would then either go to pad the budget for next year, but we're not going to budget to make sure that we have some sort of quota in giving tickets, or we're expecting to, you know, hey, oh, we're $42,000 short on our budget this year. Just so happens we confiscated this Range Rover. I guess we'll pawn that off and get our budget to square up.
Well, you can make that as an intellectual argument, but when you're responsible for budgeting and you're in an anti-tax environment, which we're in right now, we have been for a long number of years, Americans hate to pay things that they want for the thing from their government. And I invite any of you to come on here and tell me the things that you want to cut out that either your state or your federal or your local government wants to do. Because every time I have these conversations, we come up with a very, very slim list that won't save any significant money. But when you're having to deal with your constituents and they are so dead set that taxes are so astronomical that if they have to pay another penny that they'll go over the cliff, it's an additional funding component, because you either have to say, well, we factor in $600,000 worth, in a large city like what I live in. I think that that's they're raising $500,000 to close to $1 million for the police with forfeitures. Well, we're going to have to either cut officers, which nobody wants that, or we're going to have to look at more revenue, which nobody wants that. Well, why not just assess it to the criminals who shouldn't be doing what they're doing? That's very popular. It's, again, a reflection on us not willing to pay taxes and wanting to have the services that cost money that we're not willing to pay for. Now, we should have no listeners after this episode's done.
We've been trying to break it down to zero, man. Every week we try and break it down another 10%. We'll eventually get there.
So, but yes, it's like the discussion about taxes. A person told me, we're talking about universal health care. And I said, well, you know, you do realize we're the only Western country that doesn't provide health care for its entire population. And they said, well, those other countries have higher taxes. I said, well, they do have higher taxes, but it's a more just society when you have access to certain things that are considered your universal right, and health care shouldn't be based on which womb you came out of. And I said, so I'm willing to pay a little bit more in taxes for health care, but there's just such hatred for taxes in this country. I mean, we've demonized taxes.
I know. I totally understand what you're saying. Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed.
You make it possible.
And I guess then we should move on to this Washington Post article, which should be all kinds of fun. And it is, like I said, Washington Post. The Pennsylvania report on clergy sex abuse spawned a wave of probes nationwide. Now what? It appears as though, based on the, thousand victim report that came out of a handful of parishes in Pennsylvania, I guess it was actually all of the parishes except for like three or something like that, that there are now a dozen or so, 15 states that are launching their own investigations into their own Catholic churches in their states. And the list here is, it just runs the gamut. It's, I don't even know how many that is. Just all these different attorney generals, Arkansas, Delaware, Florida, on down through Washington, D.C. and Virginia.
Yeah, I'll put it in here to say I'm fearful of the end result of all this, because what we're going to have is a lot of witch hunts. If you go back at the Catholic Church, they did not handle these things the way perhaps they should have decades ago. But to go back and file charges of something that happened in the 70s, 80s, even 90s, you know, we're talking about 20 plus years ago, these people can't defend themselves. The evidence, as we've talked about on previous podcasts, you know, is not available to them. And we're going to see a further eradication of due process, because what's going to happen is there are going to be states that are going to say, well, they're beyond the zone of prosecution. Well, then we need to fix that. Justice doesn't have an expiration date. And that's what the victims' advocates, that's one of their talking points. It sounds really good. Think about it. Justice shouldn't have an expiration date.
From the victim's point of view, I think that's it sounds legit for the victim. If we're going to be a compassionate group of people, right?
But it does have an expiration date. It always has had, though, because we can't ensure fundamental fairness to the accused. So justice, right, in fact, does have an expiration date, and it should have an expiration date, but it won't have when these people are done.
And that's a very left-leaning kind of idea, right?
Well, you get a lot of conservatives that actually support in this emotional filled argument where they turn out in such large numbers, it's hard for them to say that publicly, but you actually get conservatives that are very, I suspect if you talk to the Trump people, that you get a lot of sympathy out of them for accusations that are, because wasn't his Access Hollywood supposed to be many, many years ago?
There are allegations going back to like in the mid 80s for Trump.
Yeah. So I suspect we would get some traction from them on this. And in fact, that's kind of what they're doing with the rebalancing the due process for those at the university level. So I don't know that this is just a left-leaning argument about the due process. And our Connecticut affiliate said that they got a little bit more traction out of the conservatives on issues. There, of course, that's an overwhelmingly Democratic state. But she said they've been able to make some inroads with some conservatives. So I don't know if I would say this is one of those that can't be across the aisle.
An atheist podcast that I listened to, they had an attorney from the Freedom From Religion Foundation on there, and they were all over this particular issue, and they were very hard charging after the statute of limitations.
They were very hard charging after it. In what way?
In a way to remove them so that they can prosecute these kind of cases, like, you know, the Pennsylvania archdiocese thing, like we're talking about right here, that they would be able to drive the bus all the way back 20, 30, 50 years. You know, even one of those, I think one of the allegations was like 50 or 60 years old, driving the bus Wow. all the way back to the beginning of time and trying to prosecute even, I guess you wouldn't go prosecute dead people, but, you know, some 90-year-old priest that allegedly diddled somebody in the 40s or 50s.
Yeah, this article has over 600 comments, so it has generated some, and I haven't looked through to see which way they're leaning, and I can imagine they're all for getting rid of the statute of limitations, because it sounds good. Justice shouldn't have an expiration date.
Right.
So,
And kind of the reason why we decided to do this recording is this one showed up on the radar, and this one really, really troubles me. This is out of allongeorgia.com. I don't want to call it Al-Anon. And I guess this is sort of similar to the situation in Florida, the people that are effectively homeless. But this is a Georgia city wrong to target sex offenders, a new homelessness ordinance. And they're talking about this is up in the way northwest part of the state in Catoosa County. And you've got a dozen or so guys that maybe not just guys, but people that can't get housing because either through finances and then you throw in the 1,000-foot living restrictions, they are unable to find anywhere else to live. And then because of that, there's an ordinance in the city that says they have to vacate the bridge that they're living under within 24 hours. And if not, they're hit with a $1,000 fine, 60 days in jail, and orders for community service. Now, before the show, I threw out there that these people are probably living under the bridge because they have gobs and gobs of money in the bank, and they're literally just trying to hold on to that cash so they don't have to spend it on an apartment or something like that. And that's why they're living under this bridge.
I would say I agree with you, Andy. They probably are doing that because living outdoors, and especially that part of Georgia and the up there, that would be kind of higher elevation. It's right on the Tennessee line.
Doesn't get cold.
It does indeed get cold. And I'm looking at the demographics. The county has a population of 66,000. The seat is, I guess they pronounce it Ringgold.
Okay. And, yeah. I mean, I've heard of it.
Yeah, that's and I-75, Interstate 75 goes through there.
So I'm guessing that these guys are all like, if you read the book, The Millionaire Next Door, these guys are millionaires and they're just wearing little $10 Timex watches. And again, that's why they're living under this bridge, is because they can totally afford to live in a mansion, but they choose not to save that cash. What do they expect these people to do? They can't find a place to stay, and now you're going to throw them in jail with a $1,000 fine. And there's even a sentence in here that says, well, gosh, we don't know what these people are doing at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. That's when we are most vulnerable. We need to have these people off the streets.
So, well, Councilman Larry Black, all of you who are listening in Catoosa County, brought the idea forward after he learned 5 men living under a bridge were sex offenders recently released from prison. We have no way of knowing what the person's doing so far as our safety concerns of our children at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning when we're very vulnerable, he's quoted as saying in the paper. Really?
And the new okay. Are you not in your house with your doors locked? And let's just, Councilman Larry Black, go buy some $20 security cameras. And obviously, Georgia's a pretty gun-toting state. So go get some firearms and now you're safe. What's the problem with these people living under the bridge?
Well, it's of course, that's our solution rather than having a comprehensive approach to homelessness, which is one of the weak links in our social safety net in America, which a lot of people are in denial about. We have a very, very fungible safety net in the socialist country. And if you go to any cities, even moderate sized towns like this county, you can obviously see that there's homeless everywhere. And that's our solution rather than pressing our state and federal leadership for a solution to homelessness, which would be a better solution, a resolution to the problem. It was criminalized homelessness, which actually is against the law. I mean, we're making a debtor's prison because this, yeah. If they don't leave within 24 hours of receiving a notice, they'll be arrested and can spend 60 days in jail or a $1,000 fine. And it's kind of tragic that that's the solution. They can afford that. Right.
Yes. Yeah. So 60 days in jail at what is it? $50 a day, $90 a day. I think I've heard, you're talking several thousands of dollars, and someone's Section 8 housing kind of rent would be in the low hundreds, you know, maybe $300 or $400 or $500 a month. 60 days in jail would cover 6 months of housing, perhaps, just as a guess.
Yes.
And then that person has access to a shower, which would then make them more presentable to get a job. Perhaps preventing that homelessness, preventing recidivism, perhaps preventing all of those things that would cascade down. Also, just the inhumane, undignified treatment of someone living under a bridge.
Well, this opinion piece written by, what is this writer's name? Jessica. I would not even begin to be able to pronounce that.
Yeah, that looks like it would be Zilagi. Zilagyi. That's horrible.
This, I mean, she's right spot on here talking about this, and I'm wondering how many death threats she's gotten since she's written this. But this is a horrible solution to criminalize homelessness, and knowing and everybody recognizes that they're homeless because they have no choice, very little choice, in particular if you're on the sex offender registry.
I'm trying to look through the comments to see if anybody can, if anybody throws out any examples of that. This is like, we need to keep these people locked up, and I haven't seen one yet, really. But it's also a lot of names that I recognize from people posting around the interwebs.
Well, this is kind of a Bearden claim, because you're essentially criminalizing being poor to lock people up, and there could conceivably be constitutional issues raised, but the problem is these people have no money.
And oh, here's something that looks like it starts off really well. A woman named Lori writes in and says, open letter to the council members of the city of Ringgold. Dear mayor and council members, as you sit down with your families to enjoy your Thanksgiving meal in your warm houses with the table set with your finest crystal and the table full of wonderful, nourishing food, please give a thought to the five homeless men you needlessly and heartlessly caused further hardship and damage to in the mistaken name of public safety. Congratulate yourselves on a job well done. Where is our humanity? As the temperatures in Georgia drop this week, and as these men already forced into homelessness due to our outrageous laws are told that they must leave the only shelter that they have managed to find. Even living under a bridge is not harsh enough. These men have served their sentences and pose no risk to the public, and yet this is how they are treated. I am ashamed of this council. I applaud you, Miss Jones.
Wow.
I think that's spot on.
We need to get that person on the podcast.
We might try and do that. Might be a thing.
Yes. Whatever death threats that she's gotten, we can let her know that there are supporters, he or she. Did you say it was a woman or a guy?
Yeah. Well, I'm assuming Lori Jones.
Okay. Yeah, we could. Y'all see, that's the final one. I hadn't bound it to the end here. But it looks like there's some favorable comments other than just that one.
Correct. There are. Most of the ones. I didn't find anybody that was like, oh, you guys are awesome. Just like the sheriffs in the other two counties in Georgia, their Facebook pages were just full of people giving them huge praises for putting the signs out on the people's front doors.
So, well, and we've got a program for them as soon as we can implement it.
That would be outstanding. Well, I think that's all we got. This is going to be a teeny bit abbreviated, maybe by 10 or 20 minutes, just, you know, holidays and traveling and sort of an impromptu to posting. But Larry, you're going to tell people how they can find the podcast.
Really? I'm going to do
that.
I hope so.
Trying to get you acclimated to this whole thing.
What if I don't know how to do it? Then what?
Then I guess I'll backfill it in. So, I'll copy it from a previous week's episode.
Well, they can type us on the telephone the old fashioned way on that 747. I know that. If you want to leave a message, you can contact us at 747-227-4477. And if you want to contact us by email, it's registrymatterscast@gmail.com. And there's another way of contacting us, isn't there? That's through Patreon. That's the best way.
Yes, you could contact us. That's the way to support the program if you'd like. And we would greatly appreciate it if you did.
And how do they do that, Andy?
Patreon.com/registrymatters.
And how do they find Patreon? I had a guy today tell me that he would like to listen to the podcast, but he has no idea. I said, well, go to your podcast app. And he said, what's that? So what is a podcast app?
I am continually baffled by that question. If people in general are unfamiliar with podcasts, and I did run into someone I was talking to about real estate stuff, and like she had no idea how to work a podcast. How do you contact and be in touch with people that effectively don't want to be contacted? And I don't know the answer to that. Please, if you have any insight into this, let me know. I'm curious. How do you reach the unreachable?
But how does this person who says, I want to listen to a podcast, but I don't know what a podcast app is? What is a podcast app?
A podcast app is something that they have them for Windows too. I don't use one. I have one on my phone. I use something called Dog Catcher, and I use an Android phone. And there are bazillions of them out there. and you put an app on your phone, and then you subscribe to the program. You can just do a simple search in your podcast app. If you search for Registry Matters, if you have an Alexa device and you say, Alexa, play the latest episode of Registry Matters, Alexa will start spitting out the podcast. It's incredibly easy, but you do need an app to do it. Or you can go to the website, but an app, then it just downloads to your phone when the episode's released. And then while you're on the subway, while you're driving to work, while you're doing chores in the house, the thing's there on your phone, and you press play and you put on your headphones and you bebop around the house and listen to the program.
So let's say, for example, if I have a flip-top phone, then I'm out of business.
You're pretty much dead on a whole bunch of things. You're not even really doing a lot of text messaging other than just sending letters.
So you're going to have at least a smartphone of some sort.
Uh-huh. And that individual, he used to have one. He has a smartphone now. I know the guy. He has a smartphone. I don't understand. I might have to reach out to him directly and smack him on the top of his head and say, look, man, this is what you got to do.
All right. Well, we do appreciate all of our supporters and hoping that we can gain more. But every one of you that support us is very, very much appreciated. And we find it very, very rewarding to do the work on a holiday weekend knowing that we're supported the way we are.
Absolutely. I agree with all of that. And with that, I will bid everyone adieu. And Larry, thank you very much. And I hope you had a good holiday. And I will talk to you soon.
I did. And thanks, Andy.
Take care. Bye-bye.